And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I hope that at least most of you had the chance to listen yesterday to part one of the morning show when I spoke with Ben Mezrich, a best-selling author, probably at the moment best known for an earlier book called The Accidental Millionaires, which talks about the brilliant young men who created Facebook and then sort of the squabble that ensued over who actually deserved full credit for that. His most recent book is really equally fascinating and I think will in time generate just about as much attention, a book called Once Upon a Time in Russia, The Rise of the Oligarchy and a Story of Ambition, Betrayal, Wealth, and Murder, which talks about those chaotic years as the Soviet Union is dismantled and in its wake rather strange and deeply corrupt kind of capitalism took hold in the nation, richly benefiting a small group of seven men who collectively had wealth that represented one half of the gross domestic product of Russia. I mean, it's just staggering to think about that much wealth being concentrated in the pockets of such a small group of men. And this period is outlined in Ben Mezrich's fascinating book. Well, I couldn't think of anybody better to approach to learn some richer details about this period in Russian history than to call upon our good friend from the faculty at Carthage College, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, who is one of the faculty members in the Clausen School there. And I am very, very happy that Professor Maltsev's schedule allowed him to join us today on the morning show to offer a little bit of reflection on Ben Mezrich's book and to talk a little bit further about this incredibly interesting story. Professor Maltsev, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be back.
Just so happy that that we can talk about this. When I issued the invitation to you, it sounded like you already knew something of Mr. Mezrich's book. I wonder if you had a chance to actually look at it or know something about it, if you had a chance.
Yes, of course. I've also watched interviews with Mr. Mezrich on YouTube and other sites. Yes, he was advertising his book to the point that I bought it and read it. Yeah, it's a very good book, I would say. But it's more sketches. It's not an academic book. It's more sketches, very interesting sketches, some of the good insights into the working of the Russian society, of Russian economy. But before we begin even talking about him, I would like maybe to make a kind of a little side thing, because yesterday Robert Conquest, who was the greatest historian of Russia and Soviet Union, he died at the age of 98. Mm. And Robert Conquest, definitely he was, I would say, the best in understanding the nature of Soviet society, of Russian society. And interestingly enough, he was communist himself. And in 1938, he visited Soviet Union, and it was enough for him to become, from communist to become an ardent anti-communist.
Wow. Where was he from?
He's from United Kingdom, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's from Cambridge University.
Hmm. And are there particular books of his that one should think about seeking out?
Oh, yes. The Captive Nations, the Story of Soviet Terror. From time to time, I'm teaching a class on Russia, on political economy of Russia and Eastern Europe, and we use his books. Hmm. Also, his great books about the great hunger in Ukraine. It's called The Harvest of Sorrow. And many other books in which he very rightly depicts. It's very unusual for many so-called Sovietologists, because many of them would, I would say, uncritically believe propaganda of the country which they were studying.
And he, of course, did not.
And he did not, yes.
Right. I think you very rightly characterized Mr. Mezrich's book as something that is not, it's fascinating and exciting to read, but it's not nearly so substantial as a really serious, thorough historical account by a true scholar might be. And I was actually a little surprised in our interview that he was as forthright as he was in explaining that until he started writing this book, he wasn't a student of Russia or Russian history at all. So he had to really try to learn a lot, had to have a really rapid learning curve before he would be in any kind of position to write with any sort of authority. Given that limitation, I think he does okay, but it's really important to acknowledge that he is not, he does not have the same stature as, for instance, the gentleman you just mentioned.
Yes, but I couldn't find any single mistake in his book as well. And I think that, well, we in academia would think that the best way of teaching is to tell stories, and Mr. Mezrich is doing a very good job in doing that. And so I think his book can be a very good gateway to people who are interested in modern Russian history, and then they can build up from there.
I think one of the things that would be most interesting is if we could possibly talk about what set the stage for the events that occur in Mr. Mezrich's book. Again, we want to remind people that the title of it is Once Upon a Time in Russia, and it really chronicles that period when capitalism or some form of it sort of took hold. But he doesn't say very much at all in his book about the specific events which set all of that into motion. I wonder, for the benefit of our listeners and me, for that matter, if you would offer us a little bit of historical context, because I know, in a sense, you were there. You know, in many respects, very much firsthand how the old system fell and this new system sort of came into its place.
Very good. It is a fascinating and very dramatic story. The Soviet regime emerged during the victorious coup d'etat on the 7th of November of 1917, and it survived until the 24th of December 1991. And at first, the ideas of socialism were ideas of, I would say, humanity, ideas of equality, ideas which were very attractive to many people. However, almost immediately after taking power, Bolsheviks and Lenin, they realized that that new system does not have any incentives for people to work. And so then, already in 1922, Lenin was issuing directives of applying forced labor and mass shootings on people to make them do what they want. And so socialism in the Soviet Union and elsewhere else, real socialism, because it was never communism. Communism is a utopian idea, which even Marx believed would be possible only 500 to 600 years from his time. So true socialism means government ownership of everything. In the Soviet Union, even a shoeshine stand would be operated by a government employee. There was no private property. Private property was considered to be theft and prohibited by law. And so then you need to apply mass murder, you need to apply coercion, and they lavishly did that. During Soviet Union, at the time of Soviet Union, the statistics is telling us anywhere from 43 to 61 million people were exterminated in dreadful gulags by KGB with different names, NKVD, GPU.
And was that just for the purpose of instilling fear in the populace? I mean, if you don't go to work, this is what happens to you? Or would these murders occur very specifically aimed at particular people, in a sense, not working or rebelling against the system?
Yes, at first, mass murder was applied to so-called social parasites or expropriators, as Lenin called them. The whole idea was to expropriate expropriators or loot the looters, as he would translate it for peasants. And that would be anyone who would have more than others. At first, there were kulaks, about 7-8 million of them were murdered, and another 6 million members of their families were sent to Siberia, and most of them perished there, that were peasants who were more or less successful, and they didn't want to become slaves on their own land, and so they were against collectivization imposed on them by Stalin. Then people of old nobility, intellectuals, everybody who was not in conformity with the idea of a new man of tomorrow should be gone. Stalin, he also in archives in the Library of Congress, some notes by Stalin saying that we shouldn't spend too much time on reforming people. Much easier to make new ones.
Make new people.
New people, yes. Then he also used to say that, for example, about this 43, 60 million people, and he would say, death of one is a tragedy. Death of a million, just statistic, nothing else.
Wow.
So that was the approach. And the approach was to create a new man of tomorrow who would be a loyal socialist robot, who would work for free, who would consume as little as possible, who would be kind of a backbone of a new communist society, which should emerge 500 years from now. So that was the... and then Stalin went even further, because in 1930s, he introduced regime already of random killings. Random killings, that means killings when people couldn't figure out why.
Mm.
That means that if you are a communist or anti-communist, if you like Stalin or hate Stalin, you still have the same chances of being murdered.
Mm.
And then when people realize that they cannot figure out how to modify their behavior to stay alive, then everybody began to shake with fear.
Mm. And is that why he did that? Was it simply to create fear? And towards what end? I mean, how was he benefited by sowing such fear among the population?
Well, he himself benefited of staying where he was, of having absolutely no opposition for you. He, I think, also was a power freak. He enjoyed unlimited power over people. Mm. He murdered his own family first. He murdered very good friends of his. He murdered all people who worked with Lenin on this revolution. I think he enjoyed mass murder.
Mm.
And then how the Soviet Union fell. Mr. Gorbachev, inadvertently, I think, he removed fear out of the system, which was glued together only by fear. Because since he was elected as the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Soviet Union on the 23rd of March 1985, well, elected by 11 people, by members of Politburo, he immediately began to talk about humane face of socialism, that should be human touch with socialism, that socialism is very humanistic in its nature. And nobody knew what does it mean. But there is a joke, if I may recite an old Soviet joke of that time. And the joke was that CIA didn't know what's going on in Moscow, and they sent our American James Bond to figure it out. And this CIA agent is walking from one store to another with a little notebook. He goes to bakery, and he writes in his notebook, no bread. He goes to butcher shop, and he writes there, no meat. And there is a KGB officer following him, and he looks over his shoulder, and he said, 10 years ago, you would be shot for doing that. And he writes there, no bullets. And so when people realized that there were no more bullets, that nobody would be shot, then on the good side, everybody stopped working.
Mm.
Everybody stopped working. Yes, I have my own kind of anecdotal evidence. I had a secretary, Lena, and I noticed that she was picking paper clips into her purse. And I said, Lena, why are you stealing state property in such a strange form, paper clips? And she said, Yuri, what else can I take from this? And she used very bad word, office. Show me, I'll take that. There's nothing else in this office except paper clips. That's why I'm taking them.
Hmm.
And I was walking back home, I remember that evening, and I was thinking, if the youngest and the brightest, and she was very young and bright, and she was a student in Moscow University, that if they go to work only to steal something, then that society and that economy is doomed.
Wow.
And I came up to this conclusion maybe 5 years before the CIA read about the dissolution of Soviet Union in Washington Post.
Wow. So you, in a sense, saw it coming.
Yes, I saw it coming. Also, I saw, it was very interesting that I figured out that everyone that I know never produced anything. It created, the Soviet Union created such a huge ruling elite of, I would say, nobodies, of people who didn't do much. And then when I was invited to join the economic reforms crowd of Mr. Gorbachev, we thought we have a chance to reform the system, to make the system better. But reforms were very half-hearted, very ill-designed and misimplemented. So everything which could go wrong went wrong. That's, I'm quoting Mr. Gorbachev. And even things which couldn't go wrong still went wrong. So that was the collapse of Soviet Union. It was still kind of tagging along. But in 1991, on the 24th of December, Russian President Boris Yeltsin, he declared independence of Russia from the Soviet Union. And Russia was about 80% of territory and over half of its population. So it was impossible to keep the Soviet Union together since then. It would be the same if, for example, if continental U.S. would declare independence from U.S., but Guam and Puerto Rico would still try to keep it going. Mm-hmm. So, and then the Soviet Union broke into 15 pieces, into 15 so-called Union republics. And these republics, each one of them have chosen their own way of going from socialist slavery, and slavery it was, when not only factories and plants belonged to the government, but people belonged to the government. And they, all of them, went their own ways from slavery to freedom. And we can see that the, which whiskey works, we see that those who have taken the path of freedom, who did privatization, who did democratization of their societies fast, they are prosperous and free today. And those who didn't do much, like Russia or like Ukraine, or like, say, Central Asian republics or Belarus, they are still experiencing huge economic and political problems. For example, in Estonia, today, Estonia right now is a member of NATO, member of the European Union. It's a free country with a thriving economy. Gross domestic product per person in Estonia is about $35,000. In the same gross domestic product in Belarus, it's about $3,000. In in Ukraine, $4,500. In Russia, $9,000. So you can see the huge difference. And in Russia, and I think that Ben Mezrich was absolutely right, it's not just average. It's a lot of oligarchs, a lot of people who have a lot, and the ocean of have-nots, an ocean of have-nots. There is still, I would maybe disagree with him a little bit, but because we see some growth of middle class in Russia. There is some growth of middle class. However, oligarchs who were the most entrepreneurial people who took over the national economy in the years of 1991, 1994 was a period of fast privatization. They have taken a lot. And a lot of people, I really liked with Mr. Mezrich that he realized that oligarchs do not rule Russia. And many people that I meet, even specialists in Russia, in Russian history, they think that oligarchs are manipulating Putin. No, it's the other way around. I think that he, in his book, he described the mistake that oligarchs like Boris Berezovsky and others, Khodorkovsky and many others, that they made in picking up Mr. Putin out of nothingness. He didn't have any record for anything. And they're thinking that if they would create somebody like him from scratch, then they would control him. No, they were they realized that they made a very bad mistake, and some of them are no longer with us. Khodorkovsky went to a Siberian dungeon and was rotting there for 11 years with roaches and rats. Berezovsky died under unknown circumstances in London. Presumably he hanged himself on an escort tie, but then the coroner who was studying the case still have the verdict open because nobody is sure who killed him, because nobody can hang himself or herself on an escort tie. It's just impossible to do. And so that's the story of today is more the story, not of the story of some kind of unbridled capitalism, but a story of creating a fascist economy in Russia, and that's what it is. What's the difference between fascism and socialism, or national socialism, which is fascism, and so-called international socialism, or Marxist socialism? The difference is that Marxist socialists, they reject private property in general. So under Marxist socialism, we have the whole country is run like a huge post office with postmaster general on the top. And everybody is a kind of a part of this machine. Under national socialism, property rights are still declared, like in Nazi Germany, and you could have a title for your property. But this title would be worthless, completely worthless, because you couldn't do much with your own property. It would be the government which would tell you when to open, when to close, whom to hire, whom to fire, what prices to charge, what prices to pay. This is exactly what Russian economy is today. And they have kind of a social contract between the government and remaining oligarchs, because many of them either left or died under unknown circumstances, that they can keep whatever they earned or looted or whatever you prefer, only if they would wholeheartedly support Mr. Putin and his policies and his policies.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Yuri Maltsev from the faculty at Carthage College. We're talking in part in reaction to part one of yesterday's morning show, which was my interview with best-selling author Ben Mezrich, his most recent book called Once Upon a Time in Russia, The Rise of the Oligarchy and the Story of Ambition, Betrayal, Wealth, and Murder. The period chronicled in Mr. Mezrich's book, Once Upon a Time in Russia, is primarily the 1990s. So it is that period after Yeltsin takes power that what we think of as sort of a form of capitalism takes hold. And the economic reforms that we sometimes hear about before that under Mr. Gorbachev didn't quite go so far. His reforms were more of a kind of a political and social nature in terms of this new era of openness and taking away the factor of fear. So that's the greatest way he reshaped the Soviet Union versus radically reshaping its economy. That came later under Yeltsin. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. Interestingly enough, Mr. Gorbachev, he didn't impress me as a person who would command economics at all, because he was all the time talking about something which he called planned socialist market economy, which sounds like an oxymoron to me. He was talking about market socialism, which is also you either have a market or socialism. And when Abel Agan began, who was the economic advisor, I was a member of the reform team, but Abel Agan began, we called him the biggest economist in the world because he was about 500 pounds.
Oh.
And he once, my presence, he once told everyone that we should build a Swedish model of socialism. And at that time, Mr. Gorbachev said, Abel, where you would get all the Swedes? And that was the funniest thing I ever heard from Mr. Gorbachev. Really, they didn't have a plan. They didn't know what to do.
And so, and it sounds like, from what you described, that they were still locked in a model of socialism, but trying to think about some variation on it, which would lead to people being maybe happier and more productive. But socialism, it would remain.
Exactly, exactly. Mr. Gorbachev, even today, he's pretty frail and old, but he still talks about socialist choice of humankind, that humankind will make this choice, that socialism is much more superior than capitalism. So we just didn't know. I remember that first Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. Balkin, whom I worked with, he would return back from meetings with Gorbachev pretty frustrated and would say, nobody knows what's behind this birthmark. And that was really, really a mystery for us. Does he understand what he was talking about? And Mr. Yeltsin, I would say he did a much better job in the sense that he understood that there are only two systems, and one system is socialism, and another system is capitalism, or market-based system. And he was trying to introduce that. And the program of privatization. He came up with something called 500-day plan. 500-day plan was supposed to turn the socialist economic system into capitalist economic system in 500 days. At that time, I wrote my own called Maltsev, that's my last name, Maltsev one-day plan, in which I made a point that it's impossible to do it in 500 days. You either do it in one fell swoop or you cannot do it at all. And it looks like I was pretty much right. And approximately that time, Margaret Thatcher, at that time Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, she made also the point that if we in Britain would try to switch from left-hand driving to right-side driving and try to do it in 500 days, sending the big lorries on the right only as a transitional measure, So that shows you that it's impossible to do. Only those countries like Poland, like Baltic states, like to some extent Hungary and Czech Republic, who did it in one fell swoop, they succeeded, and they succeeded in a spectacular way.
So what do you think was behind Yeltsin's thinking in doing it in that fashion of 500 days? Was that because of some hesitancy on his part? Did he think that that was a more cautious way to proceed? Or was there some other reason for him to construct this transformation in that way?
I would say that he probably was a hostage to economic thinking of majority of Soviet or Russian economists of that time. And even in the United States, many economists were thinking that that you need to have some kind of a long period of this transition so people can adjust, whatnot. But what is happening during this so-called slow transition is that people like Berezovsky and others, like oligarchs, Gusinski, that they would loot the public property because it is an orphaned property. The scale of it is amazing. Can you imagine if you will wake one morning and realize that everything around you does not belong to anyone? That you can go and take, if you have enough guts, or if you know whom to bribe, or if you know how to do this. There was no rule of law. That's the problem, the major problem with Russian economy. Even today, no rule of law. It's rule of people. And so this is the private property cannot exist and thrive if you don't have rule of law.
About who exactly owns it, how you purchase something properly, and so on.
Exactly.
So, yeah. And do you mean that literally? That, for instance, someone would see you mentioned the shoeshine stand earlier in your remarks. So, somebody could just see that, or the newspaper stand on the corner, or this little cafe over here, and they could just decide that they owned it, just sort of move in and take over. I mean, are you saying something like that was literally possible? and done?
I can just give you an example. My wife is from Lithuania, and we went to a neighboring Latvia from Lithuania. It was not longer Soviet Union. It's already independent country. And we were thinking of maybe buying some land in Latvia, which was on a seashore. It's a beautiful Latvian seashore, Baltic Sea. And the gentleman who was selling this land, as well as a lot of other land, he told me a fascinating story that he was a plot survey person in Soviet Latvia, and when the Soviet Union collapsed, he just took all the plot surveys he did and put his own name on there as an owner, and then went to a notary public and notarized it all.
Just like that.
Just like that.
No money changed hands.
No
or anything.
Money, no nothing. Yes, and he survived because nobody knew. I mean, if you, for example, if I wouldn't ask, I wouldn't know. I would think he's a legitimate owner of this.
Sure.
And then many people, then they issued vouchers. The so-called vouchers were, it was called, it's your stake in motherland. So, for example, if you are working at the factory, then the factory will issue stock shares. And they will give you vouchers that you can buy shares of your own factory or of something else. And I remember at that very time, I met a gentleman in Chicago, and I asked him, he just was a fresh emigre from Soviet Union. I asked him how about his share in motherland, and he said, I sold my share in motherland at a marketplace for half a kilo, about 1 pound of smoked herring and a little bottle of vodka. So that was his share in motherland. And he worked there for 27 years, as I remember. And that was his part of this. But those who bought from him these shares, they accumulated a lot of that, a lot of these vouchers. And then they became, either they would sell it again, or they would become, say, rightful owners of these enterprises. Mm.
Was this partly due to, in a sense, just the naivete or ignorance, whatever you want to say, of the Russian people just not understanding this new system and understanding their own stake in it and what would be a wise move? I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, there was in a place like the old Soviet Union, there was no such thing as a financial planner. I mean, they're just.
Of course.
I mean, where would one go to have your questions answered about what should I do with these vouchers or what is this new system about? I should think it was probably a very bewildering turn of events for the average Russian citizen.
Of course. Besides that, there is a very deep mistrust or distrust of Russian people to their government. Their government all the time were cheating on them economically. Mr. Gorbachev's last decision, for example, was to cancel 50 and 100 ruble bills.
Hmm.
It's difficult even to understand for an American that can imagine that federal government tomorrow would issue a statement that all $100 bills that you have in your pocket are irrelevant, are not worth anything.
It's just a piece of paper now.
Just a piece of paper, yeah. And so that's the I wrote an article in Newsday about that, how Kremlin stole citizens' rubles. And so because of that, if the government is giving you some kind of vouchers or something else, so they think that the best thing to do is to get rid of them while someone wants them.
Hmm.
But those smart ones who understood that maybe there is a chance, and they were entrepreneurial, like Khodorkovsky, for example, who was a young communist league official before, but the most wanted and the most overpriced thing in Soviet Union were jeans, just denim jeans.
Hmm.
And they were sold for, say, 300-500 rubles. Monthly average wage was 180 rubles. 180
wow.
rubles, and people would pay 500 rubles to get jeans. And so he began to make jeans, and that's why he built a little bit, and then he began to buy vouchers, and then he began to buy oil and gas industry in Russia.
But it all started with jeans, blue jeans.
With the jeans, yes. It is more or less, I think, that this kind of period of something called primary accumulation of capital we experienced in the 17th, 18th century. And if you remember, buccaneers and all kind of adventurers and con artists became rich because there were no property rights yet well defined. There were a lot of property which was kind of orphaned, didn't belong to anyone, and or they would redistribute property through theft, through crime, through burglaries and whatnot. So
that reminds me that I think Mr. Mesrich more than once in his book characterizes this period of Russian history as something akin to the American Old West. And this sort of sense of lawlessness and excitement that was part of it. And then, of course, if you were someone who's a little more brazen, a little more aggressive by nature, it was a ripe opportunity for you to take advantage of it then.
I was all the time fascinated with the history of American West. And according to what I learned about it, I would think that American West history is kind of like a Sunday school in comparison with the mayhem of today's Russia. And because if you would see that, Russia became immediately a murder capital of the world. In 1991, Russian murder rate increased 11 times. The crime was just overwhelming, economic crime. The businesses, instead of competing in the market, they were trying to murder each other's boards of directors and investors. There were a lot of hostile takeovers. News, for example, would come from Russia that the whole board of the Northwestern Bank, board of direct Northwest, that was the biggest bank at that time in Russia, was murdered during the annual dinner. And so this more even reflects not American West, but maybe the mayhem during Prohibition by the mafia in Chicago and New York.
One of the terms that fascinated me in Mr. Mesrich's book that I wanted to ask you about was when he talked about the so-called red directors. Mm-hmm. That's a term you're familiar with?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for our listeners, that would be, I think, people kind of left over from the old regime, left in control of certain entities or companies. But in many instances, one way or another, they would need to be sort of pushed aside to make room for new people who understood this sort of new way of doing things. Tell us more about the so-called red directors and, generally speaking, what happened to them.
Well, red directors, they were managers of socialist enterprises, of government-owned enterprises. They were government appointees, many of them political appointees, who didn't know anything about the enterprise that they're running or technology or whatnot. I met a lot of them because my first job in the Soviet Union was at the Soviet Department of Labor. And so I visited a lot of plants and factories and collective farms. And I would say, in most cases, I was completely fascinated, if not dismayed, by the very low quality of these managers. Many of them would be, for example, have an appointment at 11 o'clock, and a person who is a manager of pretty big enterprise in Ural Mountains cannot put two words together. And I was thinking maybe he has some disability or something. And then I realized, and then I smell the smell. And so that kind of people, many of them were taking bribes, many of them were extremely corrupt, many of them incompetent. Look what Soviet economy, I mean, the Soviet Union could be the richest country in the world because it has 11 time zones. It had 11 time zones. It had almost all possible and impossible natural resources, natural gas, oil, gold, platinum, iron ore, uranium, everything. And the country was driven into the ground by its own government and by people who, like these red directors, they were an extension of Soviet government. They were not businessmen. They were kind of political commissars at the enterprises. And And so what for them was the most important was, like for all bureaucrats at that time, to be where they are, to have their sinecure, to have their tenure, and loot whatever they can. Mm. And in many cases, you would be surprised to see how the whole family, extended families, would be the managers of one enterprise. Mm. And so definitely when the new oligarchs came, that were more anti-Soviet, pro-Western. Many of them were out of, say, 19 billionaires today, 18 are Jewish. And what does it mean? Jews were persecuted minority in the Soviet Union. Anti-Semitism was rampant and still rampant today in Russia. So that people had kind of, I would say, were under double jeopardy. Under double jeopardy as Soviet citizens and as Jewish people. So for them, I think they have more entrepreneurial approach. Some of these so-called oligarchs, like, say, Gusinski, they did quite a lot, or Khodorkovsky, to that matter, they did quite a lot of good work for their people. Khodorkovsky, he had this Open Russia Foundation. He was like Bill Gates of Russia. He was putting internet in remote rural schools in Siberia, in post offices, in public libraries. Then Gusinski was running very anti-corruption news channels with investigative journalists and whatnot. Mm. And so, but Gusinski, he realized what's going on, and now he is somewhere, we don't even know for sure where he is. Last time he was seen in New York, and Mr. Khodorkovsky, who didn't want to leave, and he in 2004 announced that he will run for presidency of Russia, he immediately was packed away on a trumped up charges, and his company, which was the best run company in Russia at that time, it was confiscated. Today there is two huge lawsuits, one in the European Union, another in Canada, that Lukoil investors are suing Russian government, and European court already awarded them about $600 million as the first payoff, but they're suing for, I believe, for $10 billion. So it will go on and on and on like this. Today, Russia practically nationalized oil and gas industry there. Then Putin put his own cronies as leaders of that, most of them ex-KGB officers. However, Putin, when asked himself that he was ex-KGB officer, he said, there is no such thing as ex-KGB, either alive or not. But
once you are, you always are.
That's right.
So is there at least in place now in Russia, in a sense, more competency? That is, do we have less of people in control who, in a sense, have no idea what they're doing, you know, the way you describe some of these old red directors? Is that less of a problem now? Is there at least more know-how at the helm of some of these companies and enterprises?
Yes, a great Austrian economist, Friedrich Hayek, Nobel laureate, he used to say that fascism is a stage when communism proved to be an illusion. And I would say, as bad as today's fascist economy is, it's not very competitive. Russian standard of living is going down and down and down because they are so much dependent on world oil prices. But from another hand, it's a great leap forward from what it was during Soviet times. You cannot even compare the two. Last year alone, 12 million Russians, for example, went overseas. That was unheard of. Russians, most Russians, have an access to the internet if they wish. The goods and services provided are just, again, it's incomparable with what the country was like in 1980s. From another hand, because I am it's kind of occupational hazard for me to watch Russian television all the time. And I just watched Russian news, yes. And the news are just horrific. I mean, the amount of crime, the amount of abuse, of alcohol abuse of children, abuse of women, abuse of national minorities. It's difficult to understand even for right now. If you will look at how Russians live, not Russians in Moscow, not those who amassed a lot of property, not even the emerging middle class, but the majority of Russians, they still live in overcrowded, substandard housing, most of them without indoor plumbing. It's amazing that to know that 56% of all hospitals in Russian Federation do not have running water or sewer system. Wow. Can you imagine? It is really Yeltsin used to call Russia cold Africa. Cold Africa.
I never heard that.
And because Russia is one-sixth also of the world territory, and Africa is also one-sixth. And the problems are like that. Yes, the problems. It's another way. Yeltsin had some kind of sense of humor. He used to say that Russia is like a Cupid. It's heavily armed, absolutely naked, but want to impose its love on everybody. And that Russia is upper volta, but with nuclear warheads, and like that. It is really very, very sad to see that today the Putin's regime, they found a way out of this dire economic stagnation they are in attacking its neighbors,
That was the best they could come up with.
Yes, yes. And the hatred, and if you will watch Russian TV about United States, you would be stunned. And it's very sad that most of our mass media ignores this. Because on Russian TV, Russian politicians, members of parliament, friends of Mr. Putin, are demanding to give them Alaska back, to give them Poland back, to give them Finland back, to restore Russia in the borders of 1850. 1815, Russian Empire had Alaska, had Finland, had Poland. Minister of Information of Russia, Mr. Kisilov, he said that his dream is to turn United States into the radioactive bowl. And these are not the people, not the random people, somewhere drunks in the bar, but these are people, are members of Putin's government.
Saying these things, making these outrageous threats.
Yes.
It's an amazing scenario. I mean, it's an amazing history, and even present day, a fascinating story. And I know that because you still have people there you know and consider friends and mm-hmm. are in touch with them, you very much have your finger on the pulse of that important nation. And this has been incredibly interesting, and I think it added richly to the conversation that began yesterday in my interview with Mr. Mezrich. And I'm grateful each and every time that you're able to join us on the morning show, and I appreciate all the rich background which you were able to offer up today. I thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It is a pleasure. Yeah.
Dr. Yuri Maltsev from the Klassen School at Carthage College joining us today on the morning show. Tomorrow on the morning show, a much lighter topic, the Westerns of Clint Eastwood with local author James Nyberg. And on Friday, UW Parkside professor Jonathan Shaler talking about his Shakespeare project in the prisons. Our weather forecast calls for clear, cool conditions today with a high of 78 degrees, overnight low of 78, a high tomorrow under sunny skies of 79 degrees. This is WGTD HD.